eyes and see nothing but devastation. They open their eyes to the same. This level of trauma damages children physically and mentally. While death is a severe and gruesome consequence of the Zionist regime's modus operandi of elimination, it is hardly the only one. Israel's genocidal campaigns result in enduring psychological scars and traumatic stress. UNICEF estimates that 1,000 children have had limb amputations due to shattered bones, debris, glass, and shrapnel embedded beneath their flesh. Young children pull other young children out of the rubble. They are unable to process such levels of grief and despair. With no air raid sirens or bomb shelters for protection, children survive repeated onslaughts by memorizing the safest places within their homes to withstand bombardment. They distinguish between the sounds of the Zionist regime's weaponized aerial drones and warplanes. Children write their names on their limbs to be identified should they be dismembered or separated from their family following bombardments. These are the soul-shattering lessons that no child should ever have to learn. But children in Gaza learn them alongside the alphabet. In Gaza, children grow up fluent in a language of grief and trauma. The caustic imprint of trauma creates scars that can bind to a child's DNA. It completely alters their genetic makeup and can last for generations. The images of mutilated corpses, the odor of decaying bodies will stay with them. Trauma rearranges and disrupts the normative developmental plots of children's lives. Surviving regular, repeated assaults requires massive amounts of energy that can delay development. Exposure to incomprehensible trauma significantly impairs the architecture of their young brains. Each new assault evokes unprocessed traumatic memories. Consequently, entire generations grow up unable to process trauma because it doesn't fit with what came before or what comes after.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourizza, with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and its ongoing raids in the West Bank. First off, a reminder of the most recent developments. Dozens of Palestinians killed, dozens more wounded in the latest attack on Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. The humanitarian crisis is deepening as nearly 2 million displaced Palestinians are having to cope with scarce tents, food, and water. Oxfam and Human Rights Watch accuse the Israeli regime of using hunger as a weapon of war. In what looks like an escalation, Israel has targeted Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon. Ismail Haniyeh, the head of Hamas's political office, is in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, in what could signal a new phase of possible truce negotiations. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has postponed a vote on a draft resolution to halt the fighting until December 20th. In the UK, a number of senior conservative MPs are piling the pressure on the Prime Minister to back an immediate ceasefire in the coastal enclave. The Israeli genocide in Gaza has killed at least 19,667 Palestinians since October 7th. Hundreds more have been murdered in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem in the same period. So where do things stand right now? Are we on the cusp of another ceasefire despite intensified Israeli strikes? What's the plan for post-onslaught Gaza? And has the genocide in Gaza brought Palestinian factions closer or not? Let's tackle those questions with Tariq Othman here in the studio with me. Tariq is a London-based Palestinian who has family in the West Bank. Alongside him, via Skype, also from London, academic and analyst Ibrahim Jamal. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Tariq, let me begin with you, just to kick things off. Your thoughts on the fact that 2.5 months later, since it all began, we're here talking about the ongoing genocide, that it's taken so long for the world leaders to begin to talk about a longer truce?
Well, there's a lot of mixed feelings about it. Of course, the fact that, you know, 75 days or so now after the beginning of a mass slaughter, a mass starvation of 2 million people, it's still to the point where calling for a ceasefire is, you know, just about on the cusp of what is politically mainstream. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do think that it shows a great resilience on the part of the Palestinian people to have survived what I don't think anyone, and me firstly, would be able to survive. I think something like 50% of the people in Gaza are currently starving. And yet we still see that after 75 days of that, there is still resistance, there is still community, and there are still some very awe-inspiring visions and videos coming out from Gaza. And so there, in a sense, it's instilled me with a sense of pride because of the fact that we have been able to to maintain that.
Let me put the same question to Ibrahim as well. Your thoughts, Ibrahim, on the fact, again, that 2.5 months since it all started, we're still seeing that genocide unfold before the eyes of the world, with countries that can put an end to it right now if they wanted to, but won't.
Yes, more than 18,000 have been killed, including 7,700 children. We've seen bombs dropped on hospitals, schools, religious sites, mosques, churches. But more than that, the nature has changed. We've seen journalists being targeted. We've seen an elderly woman and her daughter being sniped in a Catholic church in Gaza City. We've seen high-ranking officials, yes, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, as well as Pope Francis, I believe. We've seen high-ranking Israeli officials, including Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, and Energy Minister Israel Katz. They've made public statements expressing their aim to deprive civilians of food, water, electricity, and fuel. This constitutes two crimes of humanity. These are war crimes, and under the statute, Article 7 of the Rome Statute, so these are in direct contravention of international law and standards, and it is a crime against humanity.
And Ibrahim, let me ask a second question. While, for example, the likes of Ben-Gvir, Itamar Ben-Gvir in the Israeli cabinet, are calling for quote-unquote military decisiveness, which means basically continuing with the slaughter of Palestinians, the president is saying that Israel is open to a ceasefire and a prisoner and captive exchange. What do you think is happening in the so-called war cabinet in the Israeli regime?
Well, the war cabinet, the individual leading them is Netanyahu. This is a man who's been charged with corruption, embezzlement. His wife, according to original indictments against Sarah Netanyahu, she's been indicted of a fraud and breach of trust. Yeah. So she also embezzled around $100,000. They were filmed dining at a non-kosher restaurant in London, Gordon Ramsay's, whilst passing a law to prohibit hospitals giving out a particular type of bread in hospitals. So we're dealing with a hypocrite. We're talking about someone who embezzles and corrupts. And this is supposedly the leader of those that he serves. So he's absorbed these terrorists and criminals to form a coalition government. And more than that, the Israeli government, the Israeli people have voted for him. According to a recent poll, 60% of Jewish Israelis the IDF is not using sufficient force. So everything that we've seen is not enough. And the most telling and the biggest indication is when we heard of three Israeli hostages who were practically naked, holding out under a white banner of surrender and
speaking Hebrew.
Exactly. So what more defenseless individuals could you face for them to be gunned down? What more do you want? So those are those people. Imagine the Palestinians who are in a school. You've got snipers waiting outside. And these are all under the orders of the war cabinet.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned snipers, Tariq. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we have family in the West Bank. This is an atrocity, an aggression that is not limited to the Gaza Strip. There are snipers in the West Bank, the occupied East Jerusalem as well. What are you hearing from your loved ones who live there as we speak?
There's a great sense of anxiety because it's a situation now where many of the Palestinians are extremely fearful of the settlers who live near them, who, enabled by the Israeli occupation or army, are carrying out, slaughters of Palestinians. They will ransack villages, they will destroy homes and cars, and they will attack random civilians and their farmland. But more than that, there's been a great increase in the confiscation of land. There's been an increase in the demolishment of homes that Palestinians have built, and there's an increase in the ethnic cleansing of many Palestinian communities, especially near around Hebron and Safariyatta. And in these areas, Palestinians now faced with increased Israeli terror, which are acting on the basis that the media has focused on Gaza and so therefore allowed them to get away with much more. And the settlements, of course, are not slowing down whatsoever. In fact, they're increasing.
Recently they announced funding for the building of another settlement.
Yeah, so there's, Palestinians in real time in the West Bank are seeing their freedoms of movement controlled by Israel. Many Palestinians and many Palestinian villages are completely isolated from villages 1 mile away and cannot move, cannot go out to get food and water. Palestinians in villages like Jenin have faced daily raids where, dozens have been killed in a single day. And that's, of course, in the West Bank, where Hamas does not have any strongholds. Hamas does not have major political control. And it shows, I think, a large-scale domination campaign carried out by Israel, and that has been carried out, of course, for the last 75 years.
And all, of course, with the blessing of its Western backers, about which one we're going to hear. The U.S. is still engaging constructively, quote-unquote, with other members of the U.N. Security Council on the text of an Arab-sponsored resolution to spur desperately needed humanitarian aid deliveries to Gaza during a halt in the fighting. Of course, that according to a U.N. State Department spokesman. U.N. Security Council members were in intense negotiations Tuesday on a resolution trying to avoid another veto by the U.S. The vote, postponed till December 20th, had been expected to take place by early afternoon on December 19th, but was later canceled as the U.S. asked for more time. The State Department spokesman also reiterated Washington's new position against settler terrorism in the occupied territories. Have a listen.
We are engaging constructively with our colleagues on the Security Council to resolve outstanding issues related to that resolution. We fully support addressing the humanitarian needs of the people of Gaza, as this resolution should set out to do, and we're working through these issues with other countries on the Security Council. We have made very clear to Israel that we think they need to do more to police and prevent extremist settler violence in the West Bank, and we have taken our own actions to hold extremist settlers accountable when they commit violent actions, and we will continue to do that. We will continue to speak both loudly from here about it and directly to Israel.
Matthew Miller there, the U.S. State Department spokesman. Tara, I think I want to put this other question to you as well. One of the things we heard the Americans say was they're going to impose sanctions on settlers for committing violence against the Palestinians. probably a lot of them already have American passports. I wonder if those sanctions work. The UK has said something along those lines. How do we square that with their billions of dollars in military funding to Israel and their diplomatic backing and all of that?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that it's a vain attempt to save face in a way and to pretend as if they are making constructive efforts. Of course, they are militarily backing Israel and they are sending, you know, arms that are, as we speak, being used to bomb civilian targets in Gaza. But more than that, I think it won't. I don't know how many people it will affect, because in order to subscribe someone to be a terrorist, there are, you know, in Israel you'd expect courts to decide that and to delineate someone as an extremist. Mm-hmm. But in Israel, the courts will not do that. Mm-hmm. You know, I believe something like 93% of cases opened against extremist settlers in the West Bank are closed without even an indictment, never mind a charge or a conviction. Mm-hmm. So what we are seeing is this will not have any effect whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it's really an attempt to placate people who maybe aren't as aware.
And Ibrahim, same question to you, maybe UK related. We saw that resolution, that amendment to the King's Speech brought forth by the SNP, the Scottish National Party, for calling for a ceasefire, was struck down by the Conservative Party, of course, along with members of the Labour Party. And yet you hear comments such as the ones we heard from Foreign Secretary Lord David Cameron saying the same thing as the Americans have said, that they're going to slap sanctions on Jewish settlers.
Yeah, these leaders, which they don't deserve to be called leaders, both in name and position, they are sheeps in sheep clothing. The Israeli lobby is very powerful and organized. I don't know what it is that they hold on them, blackmail or whatever it is, for them to be complying with them and just unconditionally supporting them. I wonder to what extent, you know, what has to be done for them to say no. And it just seems to me that the only thing that trumps their loyalty to Israel is their loyalty to themselves. I mean, countries in America and here at the UK, there is no shortage of problems that we face. We're talking about homelessness, accommodation, we're talking about immigration, drug crime, stabbings. All of that has been set aside, and they use our tax money to support a criminal entity. Yeah. I just don't understand. I'm flabbergasted, and I don't know what it's going to take for people or for these leaders to put a stop to this, dealing with Israel. You know, basic stuff like stop sending arms and why allow? I don't understand why we allow
weapons manufacturers out of the United Kingdom. That's one way to do it.
Yes, but more than that, why is it that we have UK dual nationals, you know, going over to Israel, and these are people that support crimes against humanity and have committed war crimes, serving in the IDF or being spokespersons. Yet a Palestinian faces so many obstacles going over to his homeland, to his ancestral land. And if they do give any money or funds, they're labeled as terrorist sympathizers or fundraisers for terrorists.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand.
Yeah, it does defy belief. It really does boggle the mind. Tarek, I want to pivot to the humanitarian crisis. People, of course, are being bombed 24/7. Mm-hmm. People are dying as we're speaking. Mm-hmm. But the humanitarian situation, the catastrophe, is deepening by the day. Oxfam, Human Rights Watch, we'll be talking about this, of course, later on as well, have accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war.
Yes.
What do you think is the thinking, really, in Israel, behind denying people food and water and electricity and supplies such as that?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question to answer. There are a couple, I think, possible explanations. The first is that the Israelis on October 7th went through a very big shock in a lot of ways, and many Israeli civilians did die. And to Israelis, in order to have a sense of victory, many of them, and this has been very clear from videos that have come out of Israel, do feel the need that they need to inflict 100 times greater pain against the Palestinians in an act of collective punishment, in order to perhaps, you know, as one Israeli commentator has said, in order to sleep at night, he wants to see houses of civilians.
To kill 100,000.
Yes,
we've all seen that video.
Yeah, it's unfortunately very commonplace, and I doubt that commentator is going to have any repercussions for what he said. Mm-hmm. And another explanation, of course, is that the resistance amongst Palestinians, in all forms of resistance, is so entrenched that in order to stem resistance and in order to impose your domination against the Palestinians, you need to in essentially cut off the basics of life in order to then cut off the basics of resistance. Mm-hmm. So far, that hasn't worked. And the past 75 years of the ethnic cleansing hasn't worked in stemming Palestinians away from confronting their occupiers. But it does seem that in the Israeli mindset, and in fact in the mindset of a lot of, in the mindset of a lot of occupiers and colonizers throughout history, has been to confront any opposition to them with demonstrable violence,
and brute force.
And
you know what? It's been the occupiers and the colonizers who had to leave in the very end.
That's what's given me a lot of hope. We've lived through 75 years of, you know, perhaps not as bloody, but definitely the same mentality.
Yeah.
And just as, you know, approximately half of the Palestinians today might be expelled from Gaza, and that's their, of course, their intention. We've already, half of the Palestinians have already been expelled in 1948.
Yeah.
You know, thousands of Palestinians have already been dying. So this is really just more of the same in that sense. And in that sense, I do feel like, just as we've survived that and we've come back and we've, you know, cemented our identity, this too will only cement our identity and cement our love for our land.
We're seeing that playing out every single day. Now, Ibrahim, we see there with that contribution earlier that resistance and solidarity are coming in many different forms. What would you say, if anything, to someone who wants to get involved in the pro-Palestine movement but is afraid of the potential blowback?
Yes, that poem was eloquent and moving. So someone who wants to get involved, I would say write petitions, petition your local council. Mm. You can also download apps like No Thanks. This is an app that lists boycotted products, any products that are affiliated with Israel. So what you do is you would scan the barcode and it will automatically tell you if it supports Israel by giving funds, if it's complicit or not. More than that, the app, you can donate money. Now, I've got friends in Gaza and they are in dire need of assistance, food and water. But when I did go to give money, he told me, you know, there is no food. So what are we going to do with the money? Mm. So before anything, something has to change on the ground. And attending protests, raising funds, these are all ways that we can show, we can convert our emotions into political action. Mm-hmm. They do have a place and they do matter.
Absolutely. And Tariq, in addition to what we heard Ibrahim say, there are other people who are saying one of the ways to keep the pressure on the government to take some kind of action would be to take direct action.
Yeah.
As we have seen groups such as Palestine Action do so, which was to lay siege to Elbit Systems, the Israeli weapons manufacturer that has several sites in the UK, to their sites and try to shut them down.
Yeah.
And they have managed to do so
in
the case of two. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's very inspiring. I have to one of those particular sites. I was there with a Palestine Action allied group. It wasn't Palestine Action mm-hmm. themselves, but it was the same sort of idea. And I saw with my own eyes how effective it was. You know, we're at the point now where no single one of us is going to have the ability to single-handedly end the genocide. But there's a very interesting quote that I've heard that I always think about, and it's, "I can't do anything alone," said 7 billion people, mm-hmm. and that's the idea. And there's a lot, I think, you know, popular movements and movements directly targeting factories, for example. I mean, factories shut down for a day. That's one day's less of drones or sniper scopes that haven't been made. And on top of that, I think it's more than that, more than whether it's effective. It's, you know, what kind of person would you be if you slept through a genocide?
Exactly.
Whether it's effective or not, doing something, doing interviews, protesting, doing direct action, for me at least, is what I think I'll be able to say maybe in 10, 20 years when I've had my own children. I'll be able to say, you know, your dad wasn't entirely useless.
Or I did what I could in my capacity
exactly.
to bring about change.
Exactly.
One thing I've heard, Ibrahim, is pro-Israel commentators and others calling into question the accounts that are being provided by the different UN bodies, the so-called Professor Alan Dershowitz of the University of Harvard, if I'm not wrong, saying the Red Cross, UNICEF, UNRWA, they're all in the pockets of Hamas, in not in his exact words, but, you know, that's pretty much what he was trying to say. Why do you think they're doing that, discounting and undermining the accounts of the scale of death and destruction coming out of the Gaza Strip?
Their rhetoric has become much more extreme. You know, anyone that's against them and anyone that's not with them is against them and is a Hamas sympathizer. Also, the medium in which people consume news now, before where in the past it was just through the television, now we've got social media, we've got people with phones, and you've also got Israeli soldiers showcasing their depravity to the world and smiling about it. So these are undeniable truths, and people resonate when they see individuals being massacred. Gaza has lived through, I think, four wars previous to this. Each one has gotten worse, and the population has become younger and younger. Mm-hmm. And the rhetoric of people like Alan Dershowitz is that Hamas recruits child soldiers, and the fault is on Hamas. So, and we see a shift in their rhetoric becoming more extreme, you know, and they don't hold up to academic scrutiny. Never mind.
Now, they make those comments because they have no argument. They have lost the argument. All right, fascinating conversation, gentlemen. We're fresh out of time. With those comments, we're going to wrap this show up. Many thanks again to my guests for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
in the limelight. After facing a backlash for saying immigrants were poisoning the blood of our country, former U.S. President Donald Trump has reiterated his hardline views in a speech on Sunday, 17th of December, calling for a cleanup of the country. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. At campaign stops over the weekend, former President Donald Trump, the Republican primary frontrunner, renewed attacks on immigrants with rhetoric that has prompted opponents to compare his rhetoric to that of Nazi leader Adolf Hitler. Donald Trump challenged his role models as he parroted Adolf Hitler, praised Kim Jong-un, and quoted Vladimir Putin whilst running for president on a promise to rule as a dictator and threaten American democracy. The Biden-Harris campaign spokesperson, Amar Moussa, said over the weekend. On Saturday, 16th of December, at a rally attended by thousands in Durham, New Hampshire, Donald Trump said of undocumented migrants, "They're poisoning the blood of our country. They're coming into our country from Africa, from Asia, and from all over the world." Although some Republicans, like Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, brushed off the remark, Democrats weren't the only critics. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's running against Donald Trump in the GOP presidential primary, did not denounce the remarks when pressed by reporters in Iowa on Monday, but he did call the rhetoric a tactical mistake. "Why are we in a situation where we've even having those discussions," DeSantis said. Another Republican primary opponent, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, had a more pointed reaction. "I don't know how you could take someone like that and say that they're fit to be president of the United States," Chris Christie commented on Face the Nation. At least one Republican congressman who has endorsed Donald Trump criticized his rhetoric. "I think immigrants are the lifeblood of our country, and it's important that we have immigrants," Texas Representative Tony Gonzalez said on Sunday, 17th of December, on Face the Nation, in response to Donald Trump's earlier comments. Adolf Hitler used the term blood poisoning in his manifesto Mein Kampf to criticize the mixing of races. The anti-immigrant rhetoric was not in the prepared excerpt of the speech that Trump's team sent to reporters ahead of the Durham, New Hampshire event, but it is not the first time the former president has labeled the influx of migrants into the United States as poisoning the blood of our country. "Nobody has any idea where these people are coming from," Trump said of migrants crossing the southern border in a September interview with the National Pulse, a right-wing website. "And we know they come from prisons, we know they come from mental institutions and centers, islands, we know they're terrorists. Nobody has ever seen anything like we're witnessing right now. It's a very sad thing for our country. It's poisoning the blood of our country. It's so bad, and people are coming in with disease. People are coming in with every possible thing that you can have." In a November speech, also in New Hampshire, Donald Trump again used language that echoed Adolf Hitler and fascist Italian dictator Benito Mussolini when he pledged to root out communist, Marxist, fascist and radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country. Trump added, "The threat from outside forces is far less sinister, dangerous and grave than the threat from within our own borders. Our threat is from within." In a December town hall in Iowa hosted by Fox News, Donald Trump said he would not act like a dictator except for one day if he were to be re-elected as president. Fox News anchor Sean Hannity asked the former president whether he would use the presidency to abuse power, to break the law, to use the government to go after people several times. "You are promising America tonight you would never abuse power as retribution against anybody," Sean Hannity asked. "Except for one day," Donald Trump answered. As he did in 2016, Trump has promised to radically shift U.S. immigration policy if he is re-elected in 2024, vowing to carry out mass deportations to finish the wall along the U.S. border with Mexico, to end birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented immigrants, to introduce strong ideological screening for those entering the country, and bring back his so-called Muslim ban. At an event in Reno, Nevada on Sunday, 17th of December, Trump reiterated those promises, pledging to move massive portions of law enforcement to militarize the U.S.-Mexico border. National broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story. After facing a backlash for saying immigrants were poisoning the blood of our country, former President Donald Trump reiterated his hardline views in a speech on Sunday, 17th of December, calling for a cleanup of the country and without detailing how, promising to shift massive portions of law enforcement to handle migrants at the border with Mexico, including by recalling soldiers currently stationed overseas. "We have to clean up our country," Trump said before thousands of supporters gathered at a Commit to Caucus campaign event in Reno, Nevada. "We have to get all the criminals," he said. At what was his third visit to the state so far this year, Donald Trump dedicated nearly 20 minutes of his 80-minute speech talking about border security and immigration, reaping his frequent and hyperbolic claims that drug dealers, gang members, criminals, and people from mental institutions are invading the United States. As he ramps up his third bid for the White House, Trump is again making his opposition to immigration and pledge to militarize the border central to his campaign, at the same time that polling shows the public sharply disapproves of President Joe Biden's handling of the issue. Trump's speech in Reno, Nevada was also reflective of his consistently extremist rhetoric about immigrants, which has long drawn vocal outcry. Just one day earlier, at a rally in Durham, New Hampshire, Donald Trump sparked an onslaught of criticism for praising multiple authoritarian leaders and repeated his anti-immigration sentiment that echoed fascist leaders like Adolf Hitler, with his remarks that immigrants were poisoning the blood of our country. Last month, Trump faced a similar backlash after he compared his political opponents to vermin that he must root out, similarly alarming detractors and historians alike that said those comments echoed past fascist leaders. Trump's campaign denied that and pushed back against the criticism. In Reno, Nevada on Sunday, 17th of December, "Safer with Trump" was the campaign slogan of the day, the catchphrase shown on two screens by Trump as he made his claims about immigrants and how the Biden administration had failed to keep America safe. Trump reiterated, "Under our leadership, you were safer, your family was safer, your communities were safer, your children were safer, your borders were safer, and your whole country was safer, a lot safer." Repeating his stump speech promise to implement the largest deportation operation in America in a potential second term in office, Donald Trump also claimed he would shift massive portions of federal law enforcement to immigration enforcement, saying, "We must use any and all resources needed." Trump said that would include moving thousands of troops currently stationed overseas in countries that don't like us to the U.S. border with Mexico, one of the many sweeping promises and claims made at campaign events without providing specifics of how he plans to implement those policies.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza continues to reveal the evil nature of the Israeli regime. Now, the harrowing and deadly crimes perpetrated by the Israeli regime in Gaza are shocking to everyone, but not surprising, especially to the people of Africa, who have had to contend with Israel's evil transactions. There is a litany of Israel's evil transactions in Africa. So where do we start? In 1975, Israel sold weapons to the South African apartheid regime and even agreed to supply nuclear warheads to this racist regime. The South African apartheid regime used Israeli-supplied weapons to massacre thousands of indigenous Africans. Recently in Angola, an Israeli agribusiness corporation linked to the military obtained fertile agricultural land and ended using slave labor. The project collapsed, and it was described as Israel's toxic harvest in Africa. The Israeli regime is also an agent of instability in Africa. For instance, a UN report revealed that Israeli weapons have been used widely in South Sudan civil war that has left hundreds of thousands dead. The Tel Aviv regime is also looting Africa's minerals. A Mossad-linked Israeli businessman is involved in a billion-dollar scandal of looting Congo's minerals. Now, amid its genocide on Palestinians in Gaza, this racist Israeli regime has turned to Africa for slave labor to fill a severe labor gap in occupied territories. And lest we forget, Israeli rabbi believes that the people of Africa are monkeys. Now, does this really surprise you? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we are focusing on Israeli regime's evil transactions in Africa. So stay with us.
Israel's evil transactions in Africa. The list of the Israeli regime's evil transactions in Africa is endless. The most recent one is sending desperate Africans to work on its farms in occupied territories as part of a controversial and secret labor migration deal signed between Malawi and the apartheid regime of Israel. This slave labor deal comes as many leading political figures in Africa are calling for a total boycott of the Israeli regime.
This is not a holy war. It is an evil war by an evil regime that is driven, that is driving an evil agenda. Israel is a Zionist apartheid regime seeking to wipe Palestinians off the face of the earth. Palestinians who have all the rights to exist, particularly in the land of their ancestors. We therefore call on all of the world to isolate Israel through boycotts, disinvestment, sanctions, until they end their military occupation and allow Palestinian refugees in surrounding countries like Lebanon, Syria, the right of return.
For more on the Israeli regime's evil transactions in Africa, we have contacted Matthew Parks. He's the national spokesperson and parliamentary coordinator of this Congress of South African Trade Unions. Thank you for your time, sir, today.
Thank you.
We also have David Hundane, the founder of the West African Weekly. He's a journalist and an author in London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, let's start off with Mr. Matthew Parks there in South Africa. The Israeli apartheid regime is currently moving thousands of Africans from countries such as Kenya and Malawi to labor camps inside occupied territories amid its genocidal war in Gaza. So what's your view on this unfortunate move?
Look, we think it's unfortunate. We think that Israel right now is engaged in a brutal war against the Palestinian people, and we should be minimizing contact and trade with Israel. And that would include people from African countries like Malawi and Kenya going to work on their farms. Israel needs to resolve its problems with the Palestinian people because, in effect, that many of these jobs would normally have been occupied by Palestinian people. And because of the war against the Palestinians, they're no longer doing it. So, and hence, in other words, where the Israelis are employing African laborers to try to displace the Palestinian people. So we think it's not helpful. It's making matters worse. And really, the ultimate issue is that Israel has to resolve its relationship with the Palestinian people. We should not be looking for ways to simply subsidize Israeli government's behavior or to give alternatives. And right now, it has to address its issues.
Now, let's bring in Mr. David Hundein. I'm putting the same question to you. The Israeli regime facing an exodus of Zionists and workers from Asia is now moving to Africa for cheap labor. What do you make of this desperate move?
So the unfortunate reality of running the sort of apartheid state that the current Israeli regime runs is that when it so happens that the true face, the true ugliness of what it actually means to run an apartheid state becomes apparent to the world, it causes a lot of embarrassment, and people who previously were happy to be associated with it want to dissociate themselves. So as you rightly said, there's an exodus of people who do not want to be associated with the current actions of the Israeli regime in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. And unfortunately, it seems as if the alternative that has been adopted by the Israeli government is not to re-examine its existing policies and perhaps look for a better way of engaging with the world, but it's rather to sort of entrench itself even deeper further into its historical way of viewing things. And it's now sort of looking toward Africa as the place that will plug the shortfall. And even in the process of doing that, it is not engaging with Africa with any kind of respect. I think it's very opportune to point out and for everyone to remember that during the dark days of apartheid in South Africa, one of the very few countries on this planet that was happy to associate and do business and be affiliated with the South African apartheid regime, had very cordial diplomatic relations with the South African apartheid regime, was the Israeli government. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Konwani Nankumwa, Malawi's opposition leader, spoke in parliament questioning the secrecy of the deal of sending Malawians to work in Israel. He described the deal as an evil transaction. He said the Malawian government has gone into such an agreement with Israeli companies when it is fully aware that there is war.
Israel should really consider how does it build a healthy relationship with the Palestinian people. And they said what they're doing is to seeking basically to expel, to cleanse Palestinian people away from the territories that it's controlling. And in this case, they're seeking then to bring African laborers to Israel in their place. So when African laborers go there, in effect, they're basically supporting the Israeli government. We think this is a problem. Yes, we have seen there are some questions often, not just in Israel, but other countries too across the Middle East, who go and recruit African workers to come and work in their countries. And often the conditions are very secret. And often you see that there are real abuses of those workers' rights.
Israel has a very dirty record in Africa. The former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency, Yossi Cohen, was deported from the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2019 after he was suspected of planning a coup against the country's president. Additionally, a company controlled by Israeli billionaire Dan Gertler is involved in massive corruption in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where it illegally gained control of valuable mining and oil assets. Now, the poverty-stricken Democratic Republic of Congo is facing losses of a whopping $3.71 billion. This is for Mr. Hundein. Now, what exactly is the Israeli regime doing in this conflict-ridden country?
The sheer mineral wealth of the DRC unfortunately makes it a target and makes it an important country for anyone who has an interest in manufacturing or in geopolitics. And as you rightly said, the Israeli government has a very patchy record in Africa. So it doesn't take much to put two and two together and suggest that based on historical precedents, based on Israeli government's relationship, for example, with the South African apartheid regime, and Israeli government's role in supporting and even training the military of the apartheid regime, even in its operations beyond South Africa, as far afield as Angola, Namibia, Mozambique, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to suggest that something similar is afoot. So it could be an operation to take control of conflict minerals.
Well, thanks for that, Mr. Hundein. Let's now take a short break before we continue with our discussion on some of the evil transactions of the Israeli apartheid regime in Africa. So stay with us.
Israel's evil transactions in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, and this week's topic is on some of the evil transactions of the Israeli apartheid regime in Africa. Now, the Israeli regime is also selling weapons that escalate civil wars in Africa. A UN Security Council report revealed that Israeli regime weapons have been used widely in the South Sudan civil war. And by the way, Israel's devastating weapons are tested on Palestinian women and children before being sold to other conflict regions. Now, this is enough reason to boycott these weapons. This question is for Mr. Matthew Parks. Now, it's quite clear that the Israeli regime's military industries put profits ahead of human lives in Africa. What's your view on this aspect of the evil nature of the Israeli regime?
Yes, the Israeli arms industry does fuel these conflicts for profit at the expense of African lives, just like other countries' arms industries who also export to Africa. Whether it's the US or the UK or France or Germany, whether it's Russia or China, you'll find almost all of these arms industry across the world end up getting involved in it. South Africa also has an arms industry. We've tried to avoid that going down that route. It's not easy because ultimately these arms companies want to make money like any other company. Countries which are involved in internal civil wars and wars which are not acceptable, you know, not for self-defense and so forth, countries which are driven by ethnic conflict, etc., then nobody should be selling their weapons. And that would, for example, would include in this instance South Sudan, which has really been driven by ethnic conflict, sadly, since it became independent, you know, about two decades ago.
The Israeli apartheid regime recognized Morocco's sovereignty over the disputed territory of Western Sahara. This was part of the evil deal after the Morocco monarchy normalized ties with Tel Aviv, in a move that was rejected by the masses. The Western Sahara is a full member of the African Union. Clearly, the Israeli regime has shown total contempt to the African Union. This says a lot about the regime's attitude towards African countries.
What it shows is that the government of Israel, as it has showed multiple times, has very little regard, not just for individual AU member states, but for the AU itself. Because bear in mind that Israel has observer status at the AU, which means it requested for observer status and received observer status. So it recognizes that this is a supranational organization whose decisions ought to be respected. Now, given that the AU has offered full recognition of the Sahrawi Arab Republic, or you know, Western Sahara, as it's otherwise known, this would imply that as an entity with observer status at the AU, you are supposed to go with what the AU says. The AU has recognized this as a country. Yes, Morocco claims to have some sort of ownership claim over Western Sahara, but the AU has recognized, has offered full recognition to Western Sahara, full political recognition, and it's an AU member, right? The Western Sahara is an AU member state.
In yet another evil deal in Africa, the Angolan government plowed $70 million into the 9,000-hectare project and then contracted its implementation to an Israeli agribusiness corporation called LR Group. The project linked to the notorious Israeli military collapsed, and locals say they were used as slave labor by the Israelis. The Israeli regime is using slave labor in Africa to benefit its companies under the guise of transferring agricultural technology. This says a lot about the racist nature of the Israeli regime.
It says what the rest of the regime's history says about it, which is that historically, Israel has adopted an even more conservative line toward African freedom and African anti-colonial activities, and even some of the traditional Western powers. I mentioned earlier that Israel was one of the very few countries that was happy to work with the South African government, even militarily, during the apartheid era.
The racist Israeli regime even commits crimes against Africans inside occupied territories. Now, this regime admitted that it gave thousands of Ethiopian women migrants shots of birth control contraceptives known as Depo-Provera without their consent. Now, this action may fit the legal definition of genocide. One of the women coerced to take the controversial contraceptive speaks here.
At the meeting, they said, you don't need to give birth so many times. If you give birth a lot, you will suffer in life. You need a job in Israel. So we said, if that's true, we will never be able to get out of here.
No doubt, the Israeli regime is inherently racist, and this has been confirmed by several political and religious figures of the regime. Now, last question to Matthew Parks. Are you surprised by these racist remarks by these Israeli rabbi?
Sadly, it doesn't. The nature of the Israeli government is based upon race. You know, they don't give full equal rights to the Israeli Arabs who have citizenship of Israel, who are about 20% of Israel. And of course, the Palestinian people who live in the occupied territories in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, don't have the rights that normal citizens would have. And of course, Israel's right-wing governments have often used race, religion, and so forth as a political ideology. You'll find many times extreme right-wing politicians within the Israeli governments also, you know, espouse really offensive statements. There was reports about a deputy mayor of Jerusalem also making horrendous statements. And of course, the conflict makes it worse. I think part of the difficulty of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is that religion has become involved, land has become involved. So then it's often you find politicians resort to racism. So it really is a tragedy. And I think part of the reason why the majority of the world is condemning the governments of Israel's actions is because it's based upon race and religion. And that's really not, it's making matters so much more difficult and more difficult to resolve.
Following the Israeli regime's genocidal war on Gaza, there have been many anti-Israeli protests in Africa, like this one here.
Mine is the message to the aggressors. They've subjected our brothers to war crimes against humanity. What they're doing today is an extermination. Genocide. Is an extermination of our brothers in Palestine. And we say to them, no, no, no injustice, not in our era. We tell them, down, down, Israel.
Down, down, Israel.
Now, Mr. Hundein will have the last word in our program today. Do you think the Gaza conflict has laid bare the true racist and criminal nature of the Israeli regime?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that there were probably a number of people over the years who have been conditioned by sort of mainstream media perspectives to think of Israel as something that it was not. So for many years, for example, we used to hear that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Right. So all these narratives presented the idea that, you know, even though there is a longstanding occupation of Palestine, of Gaza, of the West Bank, Ramallah, but, you know, there's probably some explanation for it, or it's not what we saw, or it's this extremely complicated issue that nobody can understand. But what the events of the last few weeks and months have showed is that it's really not that difficult to understand what has happened here, that this is the same, this is a reiteration of the same kind of conflict that we saw for decades in Africa, which is colonial versus anti-colonial.
Well, there you have it.
The U.S.-Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza has revealed the colonial